Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Michael Ondaatje, whose latest novel is Divisadero. Earlier novels include The English Patient, Anil's Ghost. Most recent book prior to this, Conversations, Walter Murch and the Art of Editing Film. What kind of influence did you work on that book, that nonfiction book about film editing, have on a book like Divisadero?
I'd edited film before. I'd done a couple of documentaries. So that the wonder and the great skill of film editing, I was already aware of. It's an art form that's so microscopic compared to fiction, strangely. You know, you think fiction writers certainly should be aware of editing, but when you see a film editor working within the 24 frames of a second, and how if you cut from one frame as opposed to the seventh frame, it makes a huge difference on the pace of the film. And all these kind of details that are, as I said, microscopic. These were things I sort of had learned earlier on before I did the book on Walter, an obsessive editor of my books anyway. But, you know, certainly doing the book with Walter clarified a lot of the things that were there. I mean, but there are certain rules in editing film that I don't think are there in books. There is a distinction between how one reads a book, where you have time to go back and hesitate and go back the page before. And, you know, we read over a three-day period or a one-week period, whereas in a film, we're in the movie house for 1.5 hours, and that's it. So everything has to be exceptionally clear in a film. You cut from the desert to Italy. At the cut, we have to know it's Italy. Otherwise, we're saying, well, where the hell are we? You know, I think film is much stricter than a book. And so a book has a kind of element of where you could cut to a new scene and someone's thinking in a dark room, but you don't know what that dark room is.
There is a lot of editing in a book like Divisadero. Divisadero, in fact, is a very, very complex book. Well, I've only had a chance to read it once. Most of the reviews say you kind of need to read it twice in order to get more of the elements of it. In the same way, I guess, that seeing certain a Fellini movie, let's say, or certain Kurosawa movies, you get more out of it second time through.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously not really necessary to read everything twice, but no, in fact, there's a line in the book where the character of Anna quotes Nabokov, and he says, only the rereading counts, you know. But Anna is someone who's going back and looking at her life and trying to reread her life and what really happened and how it has damaged her or influenced her. But, you know, the pleasure of reading a book twice is like watching a horse race a second time. You know, the horse who surprises us with the win, when we watch it for the second time, you can see him waiting at fourth place for the right moment. And so you see the mechanics of the race. And there's a kind of pleasure in that as there is, you know, perhaps in reading a book or seeing a film twice.
When you mentioned what Anna said about Nabokov, as you were writing it, you were not thinking, oh, this book will change on various readings. Does that kind of thought pass through your mind?
When I'm writing the book, I do about, say, 20 drafts of it, and then I edit it like mad. So I'm obviously more aware of all the little fine-tunings and pitfalls and, you know, little clamps here and there, you know, that I'm aware of in the text. I obviously know that are going to be subliminal to someone who's reading it for the first time. But for me, it's necessary to have the kind of the depth of intricacy as I want the depth of character, you know. So you wouldn't probably get everything about the character of Coop or Anna on first reading, but if you went back, there might be more to see why something happened, why someone behaved a certain way.
Divisadero contains two different, very distinct stories which parallel each other and turn back on each other in many different varied ways. One of the reviews I read listed some of the more subtle subtexts that appear in both stories and intertwine with each other. Obviously, on first draft, you can't be thinking of all of that. I mean, on the first draft, you're just telling the story, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, you know, when I'm writing, I think when a lot of writers are writing, they're writing to find the story. I mean, what I do is I begin with not that much. I don't even know who the characters are exactly. But as the book progresses, the characters grow and become more complicated, and they interact with each other, and therefore plots are, you know, are formed. And there's a much bigger situation, and then there's a landscape. All these things are happening. You're not thinking about, you know, the rereading and the parallels at that point. You're just thinking about what's this character going to do now when she walks into a room and sees her ex-boyfriend there, or something like that. I'm only preoccupied with character and motive. But I think, you know, if you are working on a book for, say, 4 or 5 years, there are certain obsessions and preoccupations that are still unsaid in your mind. And it's only when you go back and look at it, you say, my God, what happens here with orphans happens there with orphans, or what happens here between parents and children happens over here with parents and children, but in a reversed way, you know. So I think that's what's really interesting about when you go back and rewrite, that you kind of see the patterns which you were not necessarily aware of, and then you have to kind of fine-tune them and make them more subtle or make them more obvious or something like that.
Apparently, from what I read, the original image that got you started on the book was of a woman being attacked by a horse.
Not intentionally attacked by a horse. I think it was a horse in a barn that had gone loco and claustrophobic and was running up and down and had attacked a woman. And that was actually the first scene I wrote. When I came to rewrite the book, there were two sisters, so I sort of had them both in the barn, that one sister comes into a barn and she sees the other girl unconscious on the floor, and as she sees the other girl, the horse comes out of the darkness and attacks her. And so they both wake up about 15 minutes later, and they're kind of not quite sure where they are or even who they are, you know. So there's a kind of identity thing going on as well.
There's a second story, the primary story, maybe not, of Divisadero, concerns these two sisters who are actually unrelated, a brother who is unrelated to either of them, and their father. And that's kind of semi-contemporary from, I guess, the 80s through to the present.
Yes.
The secondary story concerns a writer and the people he knows in France in and around the time of, the First World War. From what I read, when you began working on the segment on, what's his name, Lucien Segoro, you had no idea that that was part of Divisadero, or did you?
Well, I knew that Anna was going to be working on a French writer. She's a sort of archivist, literary archivist, who does studies on people like Colette and Dumas and so forth. She hears a tape of this man on an old recording, and something about the voice and what she sees as a pain in it just draws her to this person. She sees, I guess, some connection within her own life and this man's story, and she starts doing research on him. So I thought that was as far as it would go. And then I realized that, in fact, her version of his life, in a way, is a kind of version of her own life. So it became really quite interesting. I wasn't intentionally kind of nudging myself or the reader about this. I just then became interested in this man's life and invented this life for this writer. It was only afterwards that I could see these fantastic echoes and rhymes between the two of them.
And at that point, you begin to create depth in both stories to make a match?
Yeah, in fact, what happened was that the French story deepened the story about Coop and Anna and Claire, and the Anna, Claire, Coop story was like a deepening of the other story. So it was like, you know, this eternal complex relationship between parents and children, or between siblings and between lovers and almost sibling lovers.
Then, of course, you hit a problem because you have these two stories that you almost want to take simultaneously so they could resonate on each other, but in a book, something has to come first.
Yeah, and it was more interesting to me that the older story was the one to tell second. You know, I mean, it would be more chronologically sensible to kind of put the old story there first and then go to the present. But somehow it just seemed better because I think the contemporary story is quicker moving. It's more noirish at times with the gambling and so forth. And the pace is much faster. You know, it's the 20th century or 21st century. And then you suddenly go back in this other world where you see all those elements, but in a kind of more leisurely pace.
A lot of the book is about reinventing oneself. Anna reinvents herself, the other sister, Claire reinvents herself, Coop reinvents himself. In fact, it's almost as if it's after amnesia, a kind of amnesia that they choose to reinvent themselves. This is also true in a way of Lucien in the past, as well as his girlfriend,
Marie-Neige.
They're all doing this. How does this relate to Michael Ondaatje's life?
I think we all invent ourselves or reinvent ourselves at certain times. You know, I mean, when I came to Canada when I was about 18 years old, I started to write for the first time, and it was because I was in a new country. I was 18, I had great teachers, and, you know, I saw plays and read poetry and all this. So within about 6 months, I was not the person I'd been at 17. You know, this happened to all of us, I think, at some point in our lives, especially at that kind of crux moment of 18, 19. We have to change our lives. When one breaks up with a partner, or, you know, we go to another place, you can either continue as you are, which some people do, or you can change. And, you know, I mean, Gertrude Stein has this great thing where she says, I was an American, I came to France, and France remade me. You know, and I think that probably happened to me in Canada. You know, I was not the same person I was in England and so forth. And I think, you know, when families break up, you know, automatically anyway at the age of 19 or 20, and we all go off into the distance, and one's in Tibet and one's in Japan and one's in Oakland, you know, our lives are completely different. You stay the guy from Oakland, or you become someone obsessed with Japanese culture, and that changes you.
There's also a parallel between the two stories of people misidentifying each other. Coop thinks that it's one person, it's Anna, when it's Claire who's ministering to him. Marie Neige calls out the name of her husband when it's Lucien. Did that just happen and you saw the parallel afterward, or was that more conscious, and what were you trying to say?
That's an example of you know, I guess that subliminal obsession. You know, it's sort of natural when someone who's kind of in a state of complete confusion calls someone the wrong name, and then when Marie Neige is very ill, you know, she thinks it's a husband ministering to her when it's a man who has been in love with her all the time, but since she doesn't know he's there. Well, I think, you know, that does happen. It wasn't a very big thing in a way, but, you know, there is a kind of, there are some people in the book who desire to change, you know, like the thief keeps changing his name regularly, and Lucien Segura even, you know, writes a book under an anonymous name or another name, and, you know, Anna changes her name. So some people are changing their names and some people are being misidentified. So that all goes together with the reinventions, I suppose.
Before we move further, the title of the book, Divisadero, a lot of people have been trying to ponder what kind of meaning. One is that it means division. Another is specifically speaking of the street Divisadero in San Francisco, which at one time divided the inner city and the outer city. What's your take on naming, and how important do you think the name of any book is and the name of this book is specifically?
It is a kind of unusual name in some ways for a book, but I just sort of love that fact. I love the fact that it's a place name. It's a location. You know, it's like Chinatown. You know, it's such a kind of marker. You know, and when I was here in this area when I was writing the book, you know, the name of Divisadero was such a kind of haunting name anyway. Why? I just love the name. I love the sound of the name. And then it was a book about divisions and separations, and, you know, there's other meaning, which is that it could mean to look at something in the distance, you know, from a great height. And in a way, Anna is sort of looking at her own life, her own youth in that way, just as she's looking at the life of Lucien Segura. So, you know, it's always, for me, very, very difficult to find a title for a book because, you know, there are 5,000 things going on in the book. Which one do you focus on? Do you focus on Claire, the love story, the sadness? And somehow, because the book has these two stories, all of these things, it seemed like a title I could get away with.
It reminds me of the fact that The English Patient, the book, The English Patient isn't the central character and the major character, whereas in the movie, they made him because of the title, I wonder.
No, I think that the story was sort of, the one they were drawn to was the romance with him and Catherine. My books all have 4 or 5 stories going on. There's a friend of mine in Toronto, Port, who always wanted to write a book called A Few Novels More.
How do you feel when someone calls a book like Divisadero experimental?
I'll take it as a compliment, you know, but quite honestly, the word is slightly, it's sort of a patronizing remark. You know, I mean, I'm not going out there intentionally to write an experimental novel. You know, I'm going to write a novel and in the way I feel it can be written, and in a way that would be more interesting than the traditional A to Z novel, which follows a very clear chronology and the reader is kind of led through by the hand. I'm not trying to be difficult, you know, it's just I think there's more than one way to kind of write a novel and write about characters and time.
A book like this, after I read it and was thinking about it, I realized that it reminded me in a way, and I don't know if this was conscious or not, even from the title down to the pattern of the book, of David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
Oh, that's interesting, because I love that film. No, it's a dream movie, and in many ways, you know, the element of dream has been missing from a film for so long. And, you know, we are kind of locked into kind of horror movies in a hotel or motel, you know. And Lynch has that element of the horror movie in a hotel or motel. But certainly there's an excitement in watching a Lynch film. I mean, the pacing really is so strange. I'd be happy with that.
He also takes two different stories, moves from one to the other. One of the stories may or may not be from the mind of the other story. We could look at it and say that it's a dream, but of course that's our interpretation of what's going on. And of course the title is a street.
But the thing is, what's interesting to me is that, you know, in fact, the general public can accept a very complicated film such as Mulholland Drive, you know, and walk away from it happy to be quizzical about it, you know. But the minute a novelist kind of has a three-armed person or something like that, oh my God, this is science fiction, this is experimental, you know, you can't have that. You know, and there's a book called The Bear Came Home about the jazz musician, the saxophone player, which is a completely realistic novel, except the saxophone player is a real bear. And that's great. I mean, you know, I mean, these are kind of wonderful things that can happen with fiction, but we are kind of sort of limited to the realism of the 1920s still, you know.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Ondaatje, whose latest novel is Divisadero. There are also clues inside the book of how to read the book. At one point, Anna says everything is collage, which means that you are creating a certain kind of collage of elements there consciously.
Well, I mean, I think, again, this is, to me, a natural way of writing a novel. You know, I'm not going to write a novel about one person and one person's woe, you know, and one person's journey to become a X or Y. For me, my world is a crowded world. You know, it's not just Anna and Coop and Claire, but the people they meet, the people who change them, the people they read about, the books they read. All of these things are influencing each other. You know, I think we are collaged by who we have known and grown up with and married and left and got angry with. You know, all these things are going on. And, you know, I think we have to, well, we don't have to, but I want to represent that variety of voices that possibly exist in a book.
There's also a parallel, or seems to be a parallel, between the Iraq War today and World War One. I'm not sure, maybe just be because of the times. There is reference, of course, to both the first and second Iraq Wars. And then there's Lucien goes off to war in World War One, which now we can look on and question the motivations for the war, though at the time, of course, it was the war to end all wars. We don't question World War II, but we do question that war. And I'm just wondering how conscious that was on your part.
You know, after writing Arnold's Coast, the earlier book, which was really looking at the war in Sri Lanka in a kind of very direct way, I sort of didn't really want to kind of go back into that state of war, you know, for this novel. And I wanted it to be a kind of personal, more intimate book in some way. But, you know, certainly the wars are there in this novel. And even Vietnam is there with the Veya character. So that you're getting little signposts every now and then on the periphery of what's going on offstage. And though the book continues to focus on the people in that world.
You did a lot of research for the book. And I know that people have commented on the research concerning card players, card sharks. And there's a lot of material about card sharks. You spoke with magicians?
Yeah, I spoke to one very good magician named David Benn, who lives actually in Toronto right now. And he was great. I mean, because the thing about a magician is they are real card sharps, too. You know, they can kind of shuffle a pack and every other card would be red and every other card would be black. You know, so there's that kind of skill. And it was kind of interesting to kind of go to a very precise aesthete about how to cheat at cards, along with talking to card players who were not cheats, but they would, you know, be aware of how one cheated.
You also went to France. Now, you found DEMU, D-E-M-U, on your own?
Well, not my own. I had a contact, and that led me to somebody else who was a writer who lived in the town of Toulouse. And I was looking for a location. I was looking for a house that could house my mythical writer. You know, it's like putting fictional toads in real gardens. For me, that's very, very important to find a location that I can kind of, you know, have so that I can then walk away back to Canada and right away and with the garden there, I know where the chestnut trees and where the pond is and where the field where Anada the cartwheel, you know, exists. So that's very, very important to me, just as the villa was on The English Patient. You know, I had to find that place. I was happy through English Patient when I found the place and then, okay, now I can kind of have, you know, more activity going on here, knowing where the corridors are, how steep the stairs are, etc.
How steep the stairs are.
Yeah, I mean, even a small thing like that. So it's difficult to go up the stairs. You know, it's a bit too high or it's a bit too flat. You know, small things like that have a kind of influence. If the doors are too low or, the, you know, stuff like that makes it a reality for me as opposed to just a house.
So when the characters wander around outside in the field or they go down to the pond, that's, and maybe slightly moved in Michael Ondaatje's imagination, but that's essentially the place that you visited.
That is. I mean, everything else changes. I mean, in fact, the house didn't become at all important, what was in the house, because, you know, the characters are mostly outside in this novel.
How about the ranch and Coop's house in the
Petaluma?
In Petaluma, yeah.
Well, that was sort of modeled on a farm I had been to. But, again, that one was very much invented as well, so it was half fiction, half fact.
The sequences in Tahoe?
That was made up. I'm mostly made up. I mean, it was more about, I stayed with those gamblers and had kind of talked to them a lot and saw the lifestyle, you know, that they always had a TV on mute in their living rooms and while they played cards, for instance. It was almost a given. But a lot of that conversations came into some of the dialogue in the book as well.
When you're starting a book, you don't know where it's going, and it's all kind of coming from the unconscious in a way.
I don't think the stuff is there yet in me, you know. I mean, it's almost like going out to find it. if you say it's in unconscious, that means that everything's in my head or my heart at that point. For me, when I begin the book, I step out completely uncertain about what's going to happen, who I'm going to meet, who are these three children, what are they like, what are their characters. All of those things are going to be discovered. The place, the adventures they have, who falls in love, all those things. So you're stepping out. You're curious. The unconscious suggests that this is what I am. It's like, this is my autobiography, you know, which actually doesn't interest me at all. I'm much more interested in learning. For me, a book is a learning process.
So even after that initial, you know, I see the horse, even after that, suddenly you finish with a scene and you start writing or you start thinking and suddenly you have to do the same thing all over again, this constant discovery scene by scene by scene?
Yeah, but it becomes a bit easier after a while. So you have the girl and the horse, so we know that those two exist. Is there a friendship between the two? Do they like each other? You know, the next scene could be a girl riding on the crest of a hill and having difficulty with a horse. And then her sister comes in, and are they playing cards or what? It becomes easier. You begin with one count, then you have three counters, then you have 75 counters by the end of the second chapter.
Emotional truth is what's most important in a book like this. But then there's also facts. How important do you see the facts? I mean, if we believe something that isn't true from reading your book, and by true I mean in the real world, do you really care? I mean, are the facts that important? How much do you have to consider that, or don't you consider
it? Oh, I do consider that. I mean, there is a stage when you are kind of, you know, you're checking the facts and stuff like that. So which highway they go down on the Central Valley is important, and, you know, how exactly do you cheat at a card game? Or how to relearn and discuss this and check this with various people, you know, before the final. I wrote the kind of card game in my head, the theoretical version of the card game, but then I had to kind of say, well, what cards was everyone holding at that moment, you know? There's a great pleasure in that. You know, you are kind of making something that's believable.
So you actually played out the Texas Hold'em hand.
Yeah, I had to have played out.
Segura, the character of the second half of the book, he's a writer who's trying to deal with his own emotions and with his love for a woman who's married to someone else. And he writes these books under a pseudonym, and then he stops writing them. Why do you think he does?
I think the books he writes at the end for Marie-Neige, or in order to kind of have the companionship of Marie-Neige, it's more of that, I think. That's why he goes back to writing. And I think, in a way, he had stopped writing as a writer before that. You know, there's a kind of desolate plain in his life. And the only way to kind of cure it or to keep him going is to make art. You know, it's the Nietzsche quote that I have at the beginning of the book. So, in a way, what Anna is doing with her life in writing her story to protect herself with art is, in a way, what this man does. But that's all. It's the last gesture. And it's just there to have a companionship in the story that he's writing, I think.
You may be coy about this, but is Anna really writing the second half of the book?
Well, I think that's up to the reader to decide. I don't think I'd want to say definitely that that is her writing the book, or whether this is the story of Lucien Segura. Certainly, it's in her consciousness. She's the one who's doing the research on him, and her consciousness, obviously, it's like if you were going to write a biography of Henry Kissinger, God forbid, what would interest you about Henry Kissinger are the things that interest you. It's not the life of Henry Kissinger. And my version would depend on, you know, be on him and tall women or something like that, you know.
At the beginning of the book, when the book is setting out, what it looks like, and I'm just wondering if you thought it was going in that direction, is that somehow the book would wind up being the story of Coop and Anna together. Because that's where it seems to be leading. And then, of course, it goes off in very different directions. When you were writing those opening sequences, did you see that also, or was that not even in your consciousness?
I don't really see much further than the flashlight. I'm hoping this is going to happen. Something's going to happen here. They've fallen in love, and then, you know, we progress from there, and then things swerve this way or that way. So I don't really have a full version. I don't know the arc of the story yet. And that's, in a way, that keeps the book tense for me when I'm actually writing it. If I knew what was going to happen in Chapter 5, then I would be too relaxed or something in Chapter 1.
Michael Ondaatje, I have a question about The English Patient. I might have actually asked you this question the last time I talked to you. I don't remember. But it was on my mind. This is a comment made about the film, not the book that I read, was that an interesting difference between America at the end of the century and America at the middle of the century is that In the middle of the century, you had a movie called Casablanca, where the hero realizes that the world is more important than his love affair, and he's willing to give up his love affair for the sake of the world. In The English Patient, it's quite the reverse. The love affair is more important than the world, and the world is less important than the individual and their love affair.
Well, I think one of the things is, you know, because the book is called The English Patient and because, in a way, the film focuses on him and his love story, we assume he's the hero. For me, there's no one hero in that book. There's Caravaggio's opinion, there's Kip's opinion, there's Hannah's opinion, there's the patient's opinion, there's Catherine's. So, I mean, for me, a book is a debate. You know, it's a conversation. There's a great line by John Berger, "Never again will a single story be told as though it were the only one." With a film, you tend to tell only one story, you know, and then one opinion. I'm told I was wrong to have him as a hero, the seducer.
Well, that's why I made it clear that this is the movie, not the book.
Yeah, but even in the book, that element is there. I mean, it's more complicated, but it's still there. You know, he's falling in love with this woman, and he's obsessive. And I think that kind of thing does happen in stories and films. In retrospect, Casablanca is much more of a romance, you know, a kind of the unhappy romance which people love. But, you know, the reality of Casablanca might have been much more complicated. I mean, David Thompson has this wonderful book called Usual Suspects, I think it is. And in it, he tells the story of what happened after Casablanca ends, where Ingrid Bergman finds out that the guy she goes off in the plane, in fact, is a double agent. And is a kind of, you know, a Nazi. So, I mean, so anything can happen. And I think we are living in a time when we are kind of distrustful of the official voice of this is right and this is wrong. I mean, I think what's interesting about The English Patient and what the film did, actually, it didn't let go of that, is it didn't deny the fact that he is selfish. He is choosing this. So it's a romance in spite of the fact that it's an uncomfortable one.
It's kind of interesting that you mention that because the criticism that I read and that comparison was made prior to 2000 when there was actually more reason, at least in our brains, to trust the official story.
Right.
Now, of course, in 2007, there's absolutely no reason to trust
exactly.
the official story.
It's so shocking that we have no faith in any kind of government.
Or in the press, for that matter, to tell us the truth.
The press has been such wusses, you know. I mean, really, it's shocking. No, I don't know what it is, but I think at the crunch, you know, you had a terrible betrayal of the American people by the press in the last 2 years. So only now CNN is kind of a bit more critical, but, you know, it's appalling. I mean, that's why KBFA is, when I was here, that's all we listened to. It was such a great, Democracy Now! And programs like that.
Michael Ondaatje, where are you living now?
I live in Toronto most of the time.
You went back?
Yeah. But we've been coming back here for the last 3 or 4 years and staying in Northern California for about 2 or 3 months a year.
When you leave the United States and go back to Canada, I guess Canadian television is somewhat different from American, even though you're getting a lot of what we get. Is it easier to gain a perspective then?
Yeah, unfortunately, right now we've got a terrible prime minister who's modeled himself on George Bush, if you can believe it, and who's thrilled to come cap in hand to the United States. But what was very interesting was when the war broke out, we were in California. This was 2003, I guess. We were here at that time, and, you know, we were in all the protests and stuff like that. And then we drove back to Canada, but drove back through, like, all the conservative states. And suddenly we realized that, you know, there was this bubble around Northern California that didn't exist anywhere else. And all the headlines of the TVs were Liberation Iraq, all this stuff. We got back to Canada, and the cut line of the Canadian news was always invading Iraq. So the Canadian TV actually was pretty great when that happened, and quite proud distinction between what was going on here and there.
Do you think a writer has any kind of political responsibility at all? I mean, a novelist, or maybe not?
Well, I think he or she has that political responsibility personally. I don't know if the books have to kind of have a kind of dogmatic version of things. I mean, you tend not to trust that, you know. We hate that political dogmatic voice on the radio or in the newspaper so that we kind of think twice about listening. And, you know, I think you can kind of write about those things. It might be Lewis Carroll who does it best, you know. I don't know. I can't quite tell what's the best political novel you've read. I don't know.
Whenever I talk to novelists, they always talk about exploring issues, not finding solutions, but exploring the issues.
Yes, I don't know. I quite honestly don't think about those things. I think those things are going to come up. I mean, why does the Vare character go on about Vietnam and why do we hit those various wars in this novel? That's not what the book began to be about. But those things exist, and you can voice them without kind of turning it into a shrill note, perhaps.
But when it's going on, aren't you kind of isn't there a part of you that's trying to figure things out? Or, I mean, a lot of writers write because they're trying to understand something.
Trying to understand the human being. I don't know what virtue there is to try and understand how the cabinet works or something like that. I don't know enough about it, but I know human nature a bit more, and I can write about that.
Do you think, after having several novels under your belt, that you do understand things better, or is it just the same... just looking at it from different perspectives.
It's the same confusion after all these years.
Michael Ondaatje, do you see yourself doing more movie materials?
I don't think so. I mean, I love movies. I have a great pleasure in seeing movies, but I find the mechanics of movie making kind of always controlled by finance. They're controlled by 300 people telling you what to do and where to go and what you can have and what you cannot have, And I mean, there's so much more freedom in a book. You can just cost nothing to write down Alexandria Station, midnight. And, it would cost $500,000 to go there and film that moment. There's a tremendous freedom in books, which I love, actually.
Do you think Divisadero could be made into a movie?
I don't know how it would be made into a movie.
Lynch.
Lynch, I'm sure. I'll have audience of, small audience, but that's fine. No, I love Lynch, actually. I remember when Mulholland Drive came on, I saw it in New York in an afternoon show, and at the end of it, there was a pause, and somebody yelled out, well, someone explained that to me. And I almost wanted to go, actually, I think I can.
Well, Michael Ondaatje, now that you've spent several years working on Divisadero, and before, let me ask you one other thing. Were there a lot of false starts before you got going on this, or has this just been in gestation?
No, this one actually just went like a bang.
Have you begun work on or thinking about another one?
No. I can't leap into a book right away. I have to kind of just fill up a bit.
And what else are you doing? You're still working at all with Brick?
Yeah, we're doing Brick still. It comes out twice a year. That's fun to do because, if I'm not going to write for another 5 years or 6 years, at least I can help bring out the magazine. And there are four or five of us as editors now, so it's lots of fun.
Are you working on anything else as well?
No, I'm just thinking of various things, but, Those first ideas that come after a book, they sort of fade away after a while, so you're not ever quite sure how far that'll go.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Ondaatje, whose latest novel is Divisadero. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.